Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, April 14th, 2016, a crucial showdown. Sanders debates Clinton. In Brooklyn tonight, just days before the New York primary.
Brooklyn knows the charmer under me.
Digging into the tax-deductible music archives for some old Steely Dan today, a song about Brooklyn. And it's fascinating because Hillary Clinton has her campaign headquarters in Brooklyn. Bernie was born there. They both claim connections to New York. Hillary represented the state in the Senate. And it's going to be a very interesting debate tonight. It'll be fascinating to me to see if the moderators really allow the candidates to discuss issues, or is it just going to be a rehash of the barbs and jabs that have been traded over the last few weeks? And for some people, by the time you hear this podcast, the debate will already have occurred. But I think it is very critical for Sanders to really clarify some of the confusion that has been sown by the Clinton campaign in what I call the swift boating of Sanders. And I think that he has to clearly close the deal with New York Democrats. Independents can't vote in the primary on Tuesday. And so the polling shows that it's still a reach for Sanders to even get, you know, a point or two greater than Hillary Clinton. And the upstate vote for me is hard to predict. So I think it's going to be fascinating, and I do think it is pivotal. So I'll be watching and screaming at my TV. You can count on that. I want to note that Op-Ed News today and one of its writers, Joan Brunwasser, have published an interview with your humble host. It's entitled Peter B. Collins, The Swift Boating of Bernie. And I appreciate that Joan picked up on the theme that I launched about a week ago about how these recent attacks using the New York Daily News interview, selected quotes taken out of context, have been used to try to paint Bernie Sanders as, you know, unable to manage even his core issues like breaking up the banks. And it's a real sordid, swift-boating attack, as I have put it. And if you're not clear on my verbiage and why I use the frame of swift-boating, I've linked to the op-ed interview in the show file at peterbcollins.com today. Also, I'm releasing the first of a two-part interview series, or package, with two of my favorite people. John Nichols is the national correspondent for The Nation magazine, a founder of Free Press, the media reform group, and his writing partner, Bob McChesney. Robert W. McChesney is a professor of communications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And they've published a new book called People Get Ready. And these guys were so kind. They're in the area on a book tour, and they came to the secret studio and gave me 2 full hours of their time yesterday. Today, I'm releasing part one, which is a discussion of the 2016 presidential campaign. And yes, I get them to comment on my swift-boating remarks. But in this excerpt, Bob McChesney talks about the state where he lives. He teaches in Illinois, but he lives in Wisconsin. Both he and Nichols reside in Madison. And they know the politics of Wisconsin in great detail. And here, McChesney relates to us that no Democratic nominee or no Democrat who has won the presidency has done so without winning Wisconsin, going all the way back to Harry Truman.
I think, you know, Hillary's got a staff of people who are planting stuff in the media, and they've got all sorts of people who work in the media, their friends.
Blue Nation Review? You seen that one?
No, but no.
It's a wholly owned subsidiary of the Clinton campaign, okay. And they pop up articles, and they get picked up on Facebook, where the damaging headline is all somebody sees. Nobody actually reads it or knows where it's from.
And the other side of the coin is Bernie has a handful of people, but they don't have context of their planting stories against Hillary in the news media. You never see that. This is not, but that's not their operation.
Well, there are for a few independent Bernie bros who have offended people with extreme attacks on Hillary, but it's not part of the Sanders campaign.
That's right, and that's a tempest in a teapot, too. That's fully blown, a red herring. But what's interesting is take the Wisconsin primary, which John and I know a lot about, and I canvassed for 10 days in Wisconsin, so I had a lot of experience on the ground there. in addition to just following it closely. The Wisconsin primary has traditionally been the single most important primary in American history in the Democratic side, maybe Republican, certainly Democratic, for the simple reason that it's always the first week in April. And by then, invariably, you're down to two people, and it's the two finalists. And no Democrat has been elected president since Harry Truman, who hasn't won the Wisconsin primary. In fact, no Democrat's even gotten the nomination since 1960, since JFK, who hasn't won the Wisconsin primary.
I invite you to listen to the full interview, part one, with Nichols and McChesney. It's released today to subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And, of course, it's available at TuneIn, at iTunes, at Stitcher and Spreaker, all of the outlets where we distribute the PBC podcast. And any day now, we're going to link up and offer distribution on YouTube. I've discovered there are a lot of podcasters, a lot of spoken word programs that people access via YouTube. So we're going to add that to make it easier for you to get the podcasts. And I want to thank, as I always do, people who support my work with your subscriptions, like Don Cisney, Julie Dupree, and Casey Condon. They each kick in $10 a month to support the podcast, and they set a great example for you. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link that says menu, and then the pull-down menu, you select Become a Subscriber. $5, $10, $20 a month if it fits your budget. The $50 annual subscription is a screaming deal. And with a new annual subscription and a mailing address in the continental U.S., you qualify for a bonus book, including your choice of the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, The Burn Pits by Joe Hickman, and the fun book about the F-bomb by Ben Parker. Your choice with a new annual subscription at peterbcollins.com. Well, it's kind of amusing, but as Bernie Sanders makes a centerpiece of his campaign breaking up the banks on Wall Street, today The Guardian profiles some people, including one who doesn't want his name published. Perhaps he thinks it would hurt Bernie to have his name publicly noted. But these are bankers for Bernie. Yes, there are people on Wall Street who support Senator Sanders for president. One guy who is given the name Frank is described as a prominent New York hedge fund manager. And he says that he looks at his fellow hedge fund folk and thinks to himself, they've made so much money, yet all they want to do is preserve what they've got. It's got so out of whack that virtually nobody is willing to think about the basic unfairness of income inequality or how to improve the economy. Then there's a guy who must regret that his parents named him Paul Ryan. He's not the Speaker of the House, the Wisconsin Republican who has declined to be drafted to run for president this year. But Paul Ryan has set up a group called Bankers for Bernie. He's a managing director at TriPoint Global Equities, an investment bank that works for small businesses. He says New Yorkers are particularly well positioned to see how the rich are screwing over everybody else. And that's not all. Wade Black, COO, Chief Operating Officer at the boutique investment bank Scarsdale Equities. He says, I'm 42. In my relatively short career on Wall Street, I've watched this lurch from crisis to crisis. The Mexican peso crisis of 94, the dot-com bubble post 9/11, without exactly learning our lesson. And Wade Black says that capitalism works better if we don't have a class of banks who take all the reward and none of the risk. Now, speaking of people named Black, I'm delighted to report that Bill Black, who's been a frequent guest on this program, the guy who exposed the savings and loan frauds in the 1980s, and who has been tireless in trying to expose financial fraud in this country, he is now a top advisor to Bernie Sanders. And I think that that bodes well. Whether the bankers for Bernie come through with the critical votes in New York or not, well, we'll find out next Tuesday. I have a spate of stories today about surveillance, government spying, encryption, and backdoors. So let's dive in here. My thanks to Carl Howard for the tip on Lee Fung's latest report at The Intercept. He is a very enterprising young reporter. I've been following him for a while. And he is exposing what we know a little bit about. The CIA has a venture capital operation with an office in Silicon Valley, and it's called InQtel. And they are now investing in companies that create products that monitor your social media activities and other matters. And we're going to give you a few details on some of these. But InQtel is also working closely with a new branch, a directorate of the Central Intelligence Agency, which is called the Directorate of Digital Innovation. They're tasked with developing and deploying cutting-edge solutions by directly engaging the private sector. For example, a company called Dataminer, which doesn't have an R between the N and the E, directly licenses a stream of data from Twitter to visualize and quickly spot trends on behalf of law enforcement agencies and hedge funds. That makes you feel real comfortable, doesn't it? I mean, law enforcement agencies, you think, well, they might occasionally have a legitimate need to do this, but hedge fund managers need to monitor my Twitter activity? Then there's Geofedia. Specializes in collecting geotagged social media messages. Geotagged means location, geographic. From platforms like Twitter and Instagram to monitor breaking news in real time. The company counts dozens of law enforcement agencies as clients, and they market their ability to track activist protest on behalf of both corporate interests and police departments. Now, this is where we hit the line of fascism, where we allow private entities like banks or other, you know, hedge funds, to act as their own law enforcement agencies. These represent clear threats to our First Amendment rights if they're deployed inside the United States. Then there's a company called Pathar that has a product named Dunami that is used by the FBI to mine Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and other social media to determine networks of association, centers of influence, and potential signs of radicalization. I wonder if any of my political commentary strikes some FBI guy who is reading reports on my social media activity that I'm some sort of a threat. Then there's one more. Transvoyant, founded by a former Lockheed Martin vice president, provides a similar service by analyzing multiple data points for decision makers. It touts its ability to monitor Twitter to spot gang incidents and threats to journalists. Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's a high priority for the use of these gizmos. And let me just check off a couple more of these for you. These people have contracts with InQtel, and so there are companies that are very active in selling our privacy to the government for a fat profit. How about Parallel Wireless, which has radio access nodes and software stack for small cell deployment? That sounds similar to the Stingray devices that we've been so active in exposing here. And there are many others. You can read the full Li Feng report. It's linked in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Ah, but there's more. A federal court of appeals has ruled in favor of the government, rejecting a constitutional challenge to warrantless collection of location records from cell phones. And this is an interesting case. A couple of guys who were conducting a series of robberies of cell phone stores were silly enough to carry their cell phones with them as they conducted those ripoffs. And the prosecutors were able to use the location data from the telephone carrier's wireless records. So what's interesting here is the government didn't attempt to obtain a warrant. They simply accessed these phone records and used them to coordinate or triangulate the locations of these individuals, and then that data was used to convict them of specific robberies. And the suspect's motion to suppress the cell phone location data, contending that a warrant with probable cause was required, was denied by the lower court, which told us that we have no expectation of privacy for the location information. And they're, you know, making a distinction between the location information, which is not private, and the contents of a conversation, which they consider to be separate and more protected. But this is a very, very troubling development, and if it sets a precedent, then, well, we've just lost another bit of what little privacy we had left. Now we learn by a story from Matt Apuzzo in the New York Times, and this is based on a Freedom of Information Action lawsuit that was filed by Ryan Shapiro. And Shapiro is a buddy of Jason Leopold. They compare FOIA notes together. And this is a very interesting case because it goes back to 2003 in a case called Operation Trail Mix, where agents were trying to intercept phone calls from animal rights activists that they thought were sabotaging operations of an animal testing company. And this is also, just as a quick sidebar, this is all based on the law called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which offers sweeping descriptions of crimes if they are related to, you know, an animal rights laboratory or, you know, factory farms where animals are treated cruelly. All of this is treated separately from the criminal activity. So, for example, what I'm about to describe, the people are accused of, in one case, creating a hack where they could cause the fax machines of one of their targets to continually print out all black paper. They were also accused of attacks that caused, they say, more than $450,000 in damages and lost business. But because this is defined under this Animal Enterprise Protection Act as eco-terrorism, these offenses, which are really relatively minor, are treated as very serious crimes with long prison sentences. And when you couple that together with the FBI hiring hackers, who eventually what they did was they were able to intercept the, I think, the keystrokes of the individual computers used by the suspects and either capture the passwords or capture what they were typing before it was encrypted. The suspects were using an encryption system called, here it is, Pretty Good Privacy. And the FBI was unable to break down that encryption system. And I've been concerned for some time because I've heard reports that there are ways that they can actually see what you're typing before a document gets saved, before an email gets sent. And that is, once again, very chilling and a serious violation of our constitutional rights. Now we are learning that Dudley Do-Right and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have had the global encryption key for BlackBerry devices for almost 6 years now. In a court case regarding a Montreal crime syndicate, documents reveal that the Mounties were able to get a hold of the encryption key. It doesn't say exactly where the key came from, but it was a key that could unlock millions of BlackBerries. And the government tried very hard to keep this secret, but it leaked out in this court case. And it's just another example of how our privacy is a thing of the past. And the equivalency in these cases that I've just been talking about is that when the animal rights suspects, for example, used encryption, that is considered circumstantial evidence that they're doing illegal things. So privacy is now considered to be an expression of perhaps criminal behavior. And this is Orwellian. This is Kafkaesque. It truly is. Microsoft is going on the offensive. They have sued the Justice Department, challenging the use of secrecy orders when Microsoft gets a warrant to read people's emails. Microsoft operates the Hotmail email service. And in this lawsuit filed today in Seattle, the company asserts that the gag order statute in the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986 is unconstitutional. And Microsoft says that the pressure is on them to open up the cloud. And, you know, the cloud isn't really a cloud. It's just a bunch of server farms where you're able to store your information and you don't have to keep it on your own devices. Makes it accessible from any location. That's convenient. I don't use the cloud. I don't trust the cloud. And this is, I think, a good reason to be suspicious. So Microsoft says that the government has exploited the transition to cloud computing as a means of expanding its power to conduct secret investigations. And they claim that from September of 14 to March of 16, Microsoft received 5,600 federal demands in the United States for customer information, and almost half of that was accompanied by secrecy orders, by gag orders. And a large number of those warrants were open-ended. The secrecy orders didn't expire. And so this is a very chilling police state development. And I'm glad to see a big company like Microsoft pushing back. I also want to thank our listener and subscriber, real benefactor, Olivier de Merleau, who lives in Switzerland. And he recently sent me an item related to the gag orders imposed on people who are served national security letters provided for under the Patriot Act of 2001. And he dug up an interesting report from last November that didn't reach me about a guy I interviewed with Sibel Edmonds many years ago. His name is Nick Merrill. And Nick runs an internet service operation in New York. And it's called Calyx, C-A-L-Y-X. And one of his clients was apparently an FBI suspect. They served him with a national security letter. And he also was told about the gag order that went with it. And he defied the gag order to some extent. And in the interview he gave to me and Sibel Edmonds a few years ago, he didn't break the gag order, but he told us as much as he could. Well, that gag order was lifted last fall after 11 years, and Merrill had to go to court several times in order to develop the freedom. And I want to thank Olivier for sharing this information. I have reached out to Nick Merrill asking for a fresh interview now that the shackles of the gag order have been lifted. Two more items here about surveillance and whistleblowers and stuff. I've told you that Dianne Feinstein, my senior senator from California, who is not a friend to the Bill of Rights or our privacy rights, has been working on a new bill to force tech companies to build in a back door that the government can open at any time with a court order. And she and Richard Burr, the senator from North Carolina, who is the chair of the Intelligence Committee now, they have drafted this bill, and they claim it, you know, it's just so simple. If we can use a warrant to force you to open your storage locker and see if you had a weapons cache there, then we can use a warrant to force you to open a phone or a computer device. And they are oblivious to the true impacts of this, or at least that's the perception I have, and that is the NSA. Bill Binney told us this several years ago. The NSA wants low standards of encryption. And this is why the government with the FBI is fighting back so hard. They wanted those lower standards so that they could have access at their will. And industry has finally caught up, providing more encryption products for us to use. And if Feinstein and Burr think that forcing American companies to install backdoors is going to lead to less encryption, they're just full of shit. Because we're going to use products made by the Israelis or the Russians or the Chinese. If you really want privacy, you're going to make sure you have it. And so this is a battle that will continue. And it looks like we are all going to lose. I'm a little surprised pleasantly by this. The Senate Judiciary Committee, which refuses to meet with Merrick Garland or hold hearings on his confirmation, nevertheless unanimously approved yesterday a bill called the FBI Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. And did I say unanimously? Yes. Now, that means it must not have much teeth in it. That's the best I can guess here. I haven't read the bill. But it's described as reforming current FBI whistleblower protections by providing compensatory damages for whistleblowers. I'll believe that when Sibel Edmonds gets a $1 million check. Expanding the scope of protected activity, ending bureaucratic delays in processing cases, and allowing for case review by independent administrative law judges. So it's out of the committee, goes to the Senate floor for a full vote. And what is it called? I'm looking for the exact language here. Yeah, it is the FBI Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. And I don't see the bill number here. Oh, here it is, S-2390. Now, let me just show you, for example, how narrow this is. It appears that it only applies to the FBI. But over at the TSA subset of the Department of Homeland Security, there's a whole wave of whistleblower complaints. 87 were received in the last year from workers who claimed retaliation, discrimination, or other prohibited hiring practices. Now, that's 87 is up from 64 the year before. And these whistleblowers at TSA have very little protection. And for that, you can ask Julia Davis. And if you haven't heard that story, go to peterbcollins.com, put Julia Davis in the search window, and hear the horror story from that former Homeland Security employee. Over at Shadowproof, Kevin Gostola, the young journalist, doing a great job. He's based in Chicago, and he reports today on the report that was released by the Chicago Police Accountability Task Force, which shows deep and systemic problem of racism within the Chicago Police Department. And in its 190-page report, the declarations are, we arrived at this point in part because of racism. We arrived at this point, that's the point of distrust between the community and the police, because of a mentality in the police department that ends justify the means. We arrived at this point because of a failure to make accountability a core value and imperative within the Chicago Police Department. And this is confirmation of what everybody knows. But coming from Rahm Emanuel's task force, perhaps it'll have an impact. Between 08 and 15, 74% of those who were shot or killed by the Chicago Police Department were black. And the task force says that they cite the report that came out of Congressman Ralph Metcalf's Blue Ribbon panel back in the 1970s when I was living and working in Chicago. And I'll tell you quickly, my first encounter with a Chicago police officer, I was 17 years old. I had driven from Cincinnati to Chicago to look at Northwestern University, where I ended up going. And with a long-haired buddy, we got pulled over by a cop on the Congress Expressway. And the cop tried to shake me down for a bribe. First thing he asked for was my license. The second thing he asked for was how much cash I was carrying. And his language was, gosh, I'd hate to see you spend the night in the shithouse. And when he found out I only had $30 and a gasoline credit card, he let me go because it wasn't worth it to him. But that was my first encounter with the Serve and Protect Chicago Police Department. There's plenty of news around the world today, and I only have time to focus on one international story, and it is truly an outrage. We have covered over the past week or two the killing of a Palestinian man who was accused of attacking Israelis at a Purim parade. He was wounded and lying on the ground when an Israeli soldier who was trained as a medic picked up a rifle and from a few meters away executed him with a single gunshot to the head. This is now being prosecuted not as murder, which was the initial charge, but the indictment has been downgraded to manslaughter. And this is so outrageous because this was a cold-blooded execution. And the Israeli army claims that the soldier fired the fatal shot because he believed that Sharif, the dead man, was wearing a suicide belt beneath his coat. But if you look at the video, and I have, that is pure bullshit. He was laying on the ground and people were milling around. Nobody was paying much attention to him. And there is one line from a report that we shared with you last week, courtesy of Ian Berman, that the soldier actually got approval from his superior before he picked up the rifle and shot the Palestinian. So I don't know where this will all lead, but I hope you will raise your voice and express your condemnation of the State of Israel for attempting to whitewash this cold-blooded murder and to call it manslaughter, as so many other cases have, when the Israeli military kills Palestinians, is a deep, deep insult. And we can't let it stand. You might be amused because I don't cover sports here. I don't follow sports much. But it is inescapable living in the San Francisco Bay Area not to be aware that the Golden State Warriors are having an incredible season again. And last night they just set the new NBA record of 73 wins in a season. And it's led by this guy, Stephen Curry. He's a very interested and very talented guy. And it happens that he grew up in Charlotte, where he attended a Pentecostal Christian church. And consider that, because Dave Zirin, who writes about sports from a progressive angle at The Nation magazine, notes that it's pretty courageous for Steph Curry to issue this statement. "My faith and beliefs have always been the bedrock of my life. As a Christian, I am taught that we are all equal in the eyes of God. So I treat everyone in the way I want to be treated. Fairly, justly, and equally. I hope that is how we all treat each other." Now, Zirin says that some people have said these are, you know, milquetoast comments and that he should be much stronger. But when you consider his background and that he's walking a tightrope, he doesn't want to lose millions of dollars in endorsement money by, appearing to get in the middle of a partisan and, raging conflict like this. And so I invite you to read Dave Zirin's piece, but I'll support Steph Curry on this one. HBO is going to debut or premiere what I consider to be a drama doc. It's not a documentary, but it's a dramatic replay of the confirmation hearings of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court back in 1991 and the stunning testimony of one Anita Hill. And particularly for younger people who may not have experienced this, I've seen some of the excerpts and I saw an interview with Professor Hill herself. And I want to encourage you to watch this. I attended the hearings of the Judiciary Committee in the confirmation of Clarence Thomas in 1991. I was there for a couple of days. But I was there the week before they sprung Anita Hill on Clarence Thomas. And I saw these sorry old white guys from Hal Heflin to Ted Kennedy who wanted to sink Clarence Thomas just because he wasn't qualified. But because he was black, they couldn't find the courage to confront him with his lack of qualifications. And so then they sunk to the level, I believe, of bringing out a character assassin like Anita Hill. Now, I don't fault her for that. I think she was used in that manner. And I think that she was correct. But it was the strangest confirmation hearing that I've witnessed in my adult life. And to know that Clarence Thomas was flatly unqualified, but the committee was unwilling to reject him on that basis. And so they looked for whatever they could find. And I don't believe it was a high-tech lynching, as Thomas tries to play it out. But that's the way many people remember it. Well, I have mailed in my taxes. I'm getting a little refund from the state, a little refund from the feds. I want to renew my complaints about the Obamacare form. It's 8962. And if you've had to fill this baby out, it's really annoying and insulting. Because what it does is it runs you it makes you go through the motions, for example, of looking up the federal poverty tax table. Now, 48 states and the District of Columbia all have the same rate, and they could just put that on this form. But instead, you have to go look it up on the internet. And if you're an Obamacare insured and you don't have internet access or, you don't know how to do that, this is a burden and you got to get somebody else to prepare your taxes. Once you get the federal poverty line, then you have to compare your income to the federal poverty line, and then you come up with some weird number. It's called an applicable figure. that you find from another table in the instructions online that are not included with the form itself. And so it makes a process that could be extremely simple very convoluted. It takes an extra 20 minutes or so to look all this crap up, even if you do have broadband access. Fix it, will you guys? And finally, I want to thank Oxfam America, because in honor of Tax Day, and by the way, the actual deadline to file is Monday the 18th, because the District of Columbia has declared the 15th a tax holiday, or a holiday of Tax Day, something like that. At any rate, Oxfam has published this story called, or a report called Broken at the Top. And what they show is that the 50 largest American corporations have $1.4 trillion hidden in tax havens around the world. And the tax practices of these dodgers cost Americans an estimated $111 billion per year. It's really stunning. And so when we look at this, another finding is that between 08 and 14, the 50 largest U.S. companies, which include Disney, Walmart, American Express, Google, AT&T, Bank of America, Pepsi, and Apple, collectively received $27 in federal loans, loan guarantees, or bailouts for every dollar they paid in federal taxes. I'm going to repeat that, friends. For every dollar they paid, they scored $27 additionally in various tax credits and kickbacks and incentives. And I'm speechless. Thanks for joining me for News and Comment. You're free to share this free podcast with absolutely everyone. Will you?
Happy trails to you.